A short story is a matter of pages, 10, 12, 15 maybe. And in terms of time to read, it's about 15 minutes. Shorter than a nap, shorter than lunch, shorter than washing the car. But in that amount of time, a writer can craft an entire life, a landscape, can move your emotions and can change your mind. A short story is a fairly remarkable thing. I'm Susan McGinnis, this is Conversations, and today we'll take a look at the short story with writer and educator Antonia Nelson. Welcome, thanks for joining us. Tell me about the history of the short story. Is it long or short? I have a sense that storytellers of old told short stories around the fire or on the migration or in the village square. Is that romance on my part, or do you think it goes back that far?
I'm sure it does. I mean, I think stories probably come out of the oral tradition as all novel and written word work does. I have a sense of stories maybe being the same sort of emotional amount of space as a song, in a way. I have a feeling that might be more close to its origins. I haven't done research on the history of the story, though. I plan to at some point, but I haven't yet.
Do you think it's like the song, it's a part of us, a way we tell ourselves?
Well, I think it comes out of some desire to express a specific and small emotion, maybe in the way a poem does. You know, it's not an epic poem. It's the more focused, it's a little sonnet in a way. I think the story likes to identify smaller moments. And instead of making the great trek that a novel might make, it takes the smaller scale.
And is that, do you think, a short story's chief attribute, what it does best?
I think what it does best is explain in a short amount of space a profound feeling, a profound emotion. I think that novels, in order to be suitable material for a novel, you have to spend a novel's amount of time with the characters. And whether that means an amount of time in years for the plot to get finished, or whether it means an amount of time to cover all the emotional trajectories of the story being told, a novel requires the reader to immerse him or herself in 300 pages. And the short story doesn't require that, although many short stories may span a great deal of time. Mm-hmm. What's significant can be told in a compressed space. I don't guess that's very clear. I've been struggling with this idea of what makes novel material as opposed to what makes story material. And all I can finally understand about it is the amount of time you have to spend with the characters and the situations.
And in that case, when you're talking about the amount of time, because it could be minutes or it could be years in terms of the story, you're talking about 12 pages and 15 minutes, whatever that is, right?
Something like that, although my stories have gotten longer. Some are short. I think editors in general like shorter stories. But sometimes you have to fill out things. The stories in my collections, by and large, the average page length in manuscript is about 20, 25 pages. Mm-hmm.
This is Toni Nelson. Antonia Nelson is a writer of short stories and about to embark on a novel. She divides her time between writing and teaching at New Mexico State University. She's our guest today on Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis. When we look at a short story relative to its place in literature, we kind of balance it with novels, nonfiction, essay, and poetry. Do you think the short story stands up as an equal partner as it's seen in literature?
I feel it does. I feel like sometimes people who teach literature are uncomfortable with the short story as a form to teach. I'm not uncomfortable with it. I enjoy it. I'm more uncomfortable with novels because they get out of control. You can't look at them of a piece. in a story, you just can focus in the way you can on a poem. You can look at the line level. Everything can resonate. I mean, in perfect novels, everything can resonate, but I think it's much harder to pull that together in a novel than it is in a story, where, you know, you have the artifact in front of you. I mean, you can adjust, and it's a much more...
I feel you fine-tuning it with your hands.
Exactly.
Yeah?
It's
yeah.
a small thing. It's not a huge thing to work with, and there's a way of perfecting it. It feels like... more than you could a novel. I think you have to be willing to give up quite a lot of control to write a novel, to talk about a novel. And I think you have to forgive a novel. Frequently, you have to forgive weak elements in a novel. And I'm relatively unforgiving when I read. And so the short story has been a good form for me. It's something I can get in and out of quickly and then can revise. I can lay down the idea and come back to it. And evaluate it over and over and over, which I do. Anything beyond about 30 or 40 pages, I start feeling like things are leaking out the sides, and I can't quite hold it all.
I see. But what about the creation of language with a short story? Are you unforgiving, to use your word again?
Yeah, I guess I am. I mean, I feel like I could go back into both collections and fix them, make them much better. There's a sense of tinkering. I'm sure novelists feel that way, too. I'm sure that's not something reserved for the short story.
Mm-hmm. When's it done?
Well, you know, when it's in print, I guess everyone else feels it's done. I mean, I keep going through the printed versions, and when I have to read aloud, I read through them and start fixing them yet again and thinking, wouldn't this be better told in the third person instead of the first person? And this, you know, it has to be over. I mean, the same material will revisit me. It's not as if the material really goes away or is tamed. It sort of crops up or comes back in another form, but I go back through my books and I can find an image, a motif, an idea, a character coming back in a new incarnation because I'm still compelled by whatever it is. So they don't exactly disappear, and the revision process is ongoing, even into new material, rethinking what I thought I had figured out once before.
This feels very intellectual as a process. Is that how you hold it?
Well, I have, in most parts of my life, I think of myself as being pretty much in control, you know, but I'm still confused about things, and I think writing is the place where I try to take away some of my control. And the form, when you're talking about short fiction, the form controls the length of things, and so I'm not making this extravagant commitment to an enormous number of pages of the unknown. But I can commit myself to 20 pages of the unknown and try to just think through what bothers me, what is mysterious to me. Mm-hmm. I mean, what makes me sit down to write a story in general is something about which I feel conflicted. You know, I don't know how I feel about something, or some event will stand out in my mind as being extraordinary personally, and I want to explore it. Why is it bothering me?
So you don't start out with the phone ringing. You start out with something you're chewing on.
Yeah.
And then wait to see what that becomes in story form?
Yeah, I do a lot of writing without stopping and actually writing. I do a lot of writing in my mind, driving around, just thinking. A lot of my material is thrown out before it gets anywhere because I've worked it in my mind so thoroughly that I know whether it's still interesting. By the time I actually sit down at the computer, what I come up with, I feel confident will work out in some way. Because I do a lot of the editing process just in my mind.
It sounds like fun. Is it fun?
It is fun.
Or work?
It's both.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's the best kind of fun.
Yeah. Antonia Nelson has two collections of short stories in print. The first is called The Expendables, and for that she earned the Flannery Connery Flannery O'Connor Award for Short Fiction. The second book, and that book, I should say, The Expendables, was published by the University of Georgia Press in 1990. It came out as an Avon paperback last year, in 1992. Her second book, a collection of short stories also, is called In the Land of Men. William Morrow published that in 1992. Avon Paper brought it out in 93. And there's a German language edition forthcoming. She's also been frequently anthologized. I'm Susan McInnes. This is Conversations. Our guest today is Toni Nelson. I want to ask you about, without leaving the form of the short story, I guess we'll just come on back to it, but I want to ask you about where you publish. Now, you publish in journals, literary reviews, books, but also in Mademoiselle, Playgirl, Esquire, New Yorker. Do you send them different stories? Do you send them different versions of the same story?
I guess it's a question of audience, and I have a lot of students whose idea of writing is sort of audience generated. That is, they would like to write a women's magazine story, or you know, a New Yorker story, or a men's magazine story, etc. And I think that almost never works, to write with an audience in mind, because what you end up doing is being untrue to your material, first of all, and maybe you're not taking the material seriously if you're thinking this is the kind of thing that a women's magazine might like, and then writing toward that. I think the smart thing to do, and probably what most writers would tell you they do, is to write a story and to sort of assess it. You know, thinking, where could I imagine this being published? I send almost everything to the New Yorker first, almost everything. There are a few things I feel confident they aren't going to take, but I think they like to be surprising. I think they like to think of themselves, the New Yorker, as a magazine that's willing to take chances on fiction. I think they do take those chances, and it's the best place to be published as a short story writer. I mean, they pay very well, and there's a lot of prestige. Everybody reads it. Hear, once you have a story out, you sort of think, all right, I'm waiting for the applause to come in. And it doesn't with the literary magazines as much as you might hope, but with somewhere like the New Yorker, it does. And it's nice to hear what people think of your work, however lonesome the act of writing is. Publication oughtn't be so lonesome, and sometimes it also is lonesome. So that's part of the gratification of having something in the New Yorker. I do think it's true that by and large magazines are looking for kinds of stories, but I think it's hard as a writer to determine what those stories might be. Mm-hmm. It surprised me when Red Book took the title story of the second collection, In the Land of Men. It's not what I would have conceived of as a Red Book story.
Okay, a Red Book story. Right.
Happy I sent it to them, because it's nice to get, you know, 15,000, I don't even know what their circulation is, but it's nice to think that it's sitting on all these racks and all these places that somebody actually might read it.
Well, one of the things that interested me about that is that it tells me that a short story is very versatile, mm-hmm, within our culture. That is to say, it is both an art, publishable in journals, uh-huh, publishable by William Morrow or Knopf or, you know, fairly, fairly high-flown companies, and at the same time, it's a popular, it's an art of the popular culture. Mm-hmm. So that Red Book will take a look,
right,
at In the Land of Men, a story it published as Revenge, and right, sees value in it.
Yeah. Well, that story was published first in a literary magazine, and the literary magazine, Tri-Quarterly magazine, mm-hmm, took it as it was, published it as it was, and with my title. And then Red Book, when they republished, took out a few lines they didn't feel were necessary in the story, and maybe they were a little racy, these lines, and then changed the title. And that was fine with me, I guess, because it had been published as I wanted it published in one place, and mm-hmm, then really I was just giving it over, I guess, selling it. I I mean, you sell it and you hope for the best, but they do retain the right to change things without consulting you, I guess.
Do you swallow hard when that happens, or is it in someone else's hands so it belongs to them?
Both. I also felt, I guess with that story, that I'd had what I wanted, and in the book it's as I want it.
Tell, for those who might not have read it, tell us a little bit about that story. It's a fascinating look at a woman's predicament.
It's a story about a woman who's been raped in the past. The present action is her being picked up at the restaurant where she works by one of her brothers. She anticipates that every evening that one of them will pick her up, because it was walking home from work that she got raped a year before. And on the night that the story begins on, all three brothers show up, and she gets in the car with them. And as they're driving away, they tell her that they've done what the police have been unable to do, and that is to catch her rapist. And they tell her that he's in the trunk of the car she's driving along in. And they decide that she'll be the one to give him what he deserves, to get revenge. And her trying to decide what is the right thing to do is sort of how the struggle moves, I mean, how the story moves along. Because it's not an easy decision to make.
And did that story have its conception or its birth with you thinking what would be the right thing to do?
Well, it actually started after I read something in the newspaper a few years ago. You may remember this story. It was pretty, I think it was out on the AP Wire maybe. There was a couple in Philadelphia, I think it's Philadelphia, whose daughter had been raped in a park, and the police had been unable to apprehend the rapist, and the parents took it upon themselves to find this fellow, and the woman sat as a sort of a plant. I mean, I don't know what you call it. She was waiting to be victimized, and the husband hid, and eventually the same person, I don't know how they determined it was the right guy, did try to rape her, tried to get her. The husband leapt from the bushes, and they were both in a lot of danger, but eventually the guy was taken in. Well, I was really interested in that. I was interested in the idea of taking the law into your own hands, and of the family being so motivated to find this guy, you know, motivated in a way the police are not, cannot be, personally motivated. And I decided I wanted to make I wanted to make the issue a little more polarized, you know, men and women, where, as I see it, the girl in this story is victimized once by the rapist, and then a second time by her brothers, who are also men, and in various stages of becoming grown-ups and, you know, seeking their own way in the land of men. So I wanted to make things a little more extreme, and I wanted also to make them younger, so that the tension would be, they would be more vulnerable, and also capable maybe of more humor, and I think that they're more sympathetic. I think characters are more sympathetic when they're young and making silly mistakes than when they're older and making silly mistakes. It means different things. But anyway, that's the story became. It's the issue of what is the right thing to do. It began as a premise that really fascinated me. And I can't say why the premise fascinated me so much. I mean, we all read the papers, and there are any number of horror stories you read in the papers. Why does one stay with you and the rest wash over? I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe in some very deep unconscious part of myself, it's precisely the predicament I bring the story to. What is she going to do? Maybe that is what fascinated me, but I wouldn't know how to name that consciously until after I'd written my way out of it.
In this story, you leave her saying, I'll think about it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think those are the last words,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I'm thinking. In fact, the first time Robert, my husband, who's also a writer, read the story, he said, no, you can't end here. You can't end here because she hasn't made a decision. You haven't finished this story. And usually I listen to him, and in this case I didn't. I decided that what was most fascinating to me was the impossibility of making the right decision, and that in order to highlight that, in order to focus on that as a kind of epiphanic moment, I had to give up the other side of the arc. I had to stop there and say, there is no right decision. She's in the situation that the reader will be at the end of the story thinking, what is the right decision?
In this way, is writing for you the treading on the moral ground, examining what's ethical, what's moral, what's right, what's possible?
I guess
possible?
It is. I mean, I don't think I would ever, I hope I don't ever stop and judge. I really, I try to resist that, although I suppose it's hard for anybody to really do. But I think the best fiction doesn't judge so much as it presents as many sides of the story as it can, and then leaves the reader, you know, to make some judgment and to let that judgment carry over into the reader's life. I mean, I feel like fiction, art, any art, but reading fiction and poetry, it ought to be able to change your life. It ought to make you a better human in the world once you understand the other people in the world.
Do you want me to do something more than read?
I guess ideally the reader thinks about things and identifies with a whole smorgasbord of characters, you know. As suddenly an issue that might have seemed simple on the surface becomes a whole lot more complicated. I hope that's, you know, the way people read.
So at the very least, you want me to sit up and take notice.
And be disturbed. I guess that, little disruption in the psyche is what I'm after.
As long as you're going to be disrupted.
Everyone ought to be a little disrupted.
Our guest today on Conversations is Antonia Nelson. She was educated at the University of Arizona and at the University of Kansas. Her undergraduate degree in English literature was taken with honors from the University of Kansas in 1983, also a minor in art history. After that, in 1986, she was granted an MFA from the University of Arizona in creative writing. As I mentioned, she teaches half-time creative writing at New Mexico State University, a position divided with your husband, Robert Boswell, also a writer, and spends the rest of her time, along with Robert Boswell, raising two children and writing. Two books now in The Land of Men and The Expendables, both in hardback and in paperback, and a new collection of short stories.
Mm-hmm.
Who will be the publisher of that?
Houghton Mifflin.
Houghton Mifflin. And an option, as they say, on a novel for Antonia Nelson. I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Conversations on KUAC. Do you set beyond, say, moral and ethical and intellectual questions for yourself? Do you set technical challenges for yourself in your writing? Are you looking to move this craft forward with each story or every few stories?
Oh, that's a good question. I know I ask my students to do that. I don't guess I'm quite as demanding of myself, maybe in that respect. I guess the central question for me is who should be telling the story and why at this particular moment. And once I've established those things, which sound maybe simple, but they aren't, once I've established those, the stories have their own tone and setting and sense of movement. For example, if it's a young child telling the story from first-person point of view, then I've already set an awfully lot of limits on myself. And I'm not really willing to do that. So typically, if it's a child's point of view, I will step back and put the story in third person so that I can retain the right as narrator to use language that child's incapable of using.
Do you ever start out in one perspective and say, oops, that didn't work? And
I think that's the kind of pre-writing exercise I was talking about before, I try to get through before I get to the page, although that's not always the case. There are times when I've written 15, 20 pages and I'll suddenly realize this is not this guy's story. I have to stop and tell it from his wife's point of view, and then the story takes off, and I know that that was the place I should have been all along. Mm-hmm. Many times you don't know where you ought to be until you try something that isn't the right place.
Let's take a look at a story. We've okay. got a couple marked out to take a look at. One is the control group. About a little fellow named T.V. Mitchell. Do you mm-hmm. want to introduce that? So folks know where we're going, or do you yeah. want to just...
Well, this story is... the character's name is T.V., and he's 10 years old. I'm just going to start it, so it doesn't probably require much more than that. Great. It's called The Control Group. T.V. Mitchell fell in love with his fourth grade teacher. An odd and uncomfortable prospect, his love was a secret he confessed to nobody. Not that there was anybody he could have confessed to, and not that he quite understood his feelings as, in fact, ones of love. He knew simply an unbearable ache, like illness. The knot in his gut Mrs. Dugas could tie and twist with such torque, he thought he might, quite literally, die. And T.V., alone among his 9-year-old peers at Hamilton Elementary, did comprehend death. Unlike his baffling love for his 52-year-old teacher, he spoke freely about that which he understood. His mother had murdered her father, T.V.'s grandfather. T.V.'s tale did not differ substantially from the other gruesome stories heard over lunch by the boys' corner of the playground, but his had the unbeatable edge of truth. The others might escalate their stakes, recount babysitters finding dripping blood in the bath or vampires under the bed, phone calls from hatchet-bearing mental escapees, timely electrical blackouts, hairy hands sprouting from the seeming innocence of wing chairs or garden spigots. But they couldn't outdo TV's penetrating simplicity. She pounded him with a hammer, he told the boys. They stood scuffing dirt, hands balled in front pockets. She stuffed a handkerchief in his mouth, T.V. went on, to keep him quiet. He carried the handkerchief with him for further drama, its pure whiteness and ancient embroidered monogram somehow proof enough. T.V.M., his grandfather's and his own initials, the navy threads worn nearly away under T.V.'s worrying fingertips. A single blow to the forehead, a round blue contusion meant to resemble a bruise from an accidental fall.
From a story called The Control Group, it's taken from the collection In the Land of Men, an Avon paperback. Did you begin by wondering what would be too enormous for a little one to carry?
This story comes from about 3 different autobiographical sources, ranging from my own experience with a couple of grade school teachers who've been fused into one character, and an experience that my brother, who's a psychologist, had with a child whose mother had killed her father. A really bright little boy who, after this event was thrown into the mercy of foster homes and psychologists and all sorts of things. And then I have this fictional family that I've written a novella about, and the foster mother in this story is a member of this family, and so those 3 things kind of came together in the story. I do like, I guess, to put characters at some sort of risk, and the risk has to be one that's specifically going to push their buttons. Here's a boy who cannot be sure what love is anymore, because what he's witnessed of familial love is that a daughter has been willing to kill her father, and his mother is then, a stranger to him, and he's then put in the home of a stranger who probably could love him, and it's a mess, and so what I guess he ends up doing is attaching himself to someone who seems solid and unwilling to be sentimental. The character of Mrs. Dugas is, I'm really fond of her, although some people have read the story and said, oh, she's so hard on him. Right. But I think kids kind of respond to somebody who isn't gonna change. No matter what is gonna happen, those people will be the same, and I think that's probably what attracts him to her. Plus, she loves animals, and kids identify with that. I think maybe we all do. Mm-hmm. And animal lovers, in general, maybe somebody you can trust.
When you step away from this story as the writer, is TV going to make it?
Well, he's in the novella it's the title. The novella is called Family Terrorists, and it's the title story of the new collection that will be out next year. And he, I hate to say, doesn't fare too well in his new family, unfortunately. Bad things happen. He gets older, and it isn't particularly good for him.
When you carry characters forward from story to story, do they get even more real than... I mean, do they pad around the living room at night when you guys are abed or in the shower or something?
I do think of what they would do, and I think that they give me, if they have a history in my fictional consciousness, I think that they emerge on the page more complex, probably, because I feel more confident of where they've come from. But by the same token, they're so confused. Frequently, they won't do what I need them to do in a particular story because that wasn't a part of their past, and that can be annoying when I don't have the freedom to make them behave in certain ways because that's not who they are. I've had to rearrange lives.
Of course, that's a bother. Right?
That is a bother. Well, they're a little bit like family members, you know, the ones that you like them, but you wish they'd just settle down or
go back and get that degree.
That's right.
Divorce him. I mean, he's ridiculous. Antonia Nelson, struggling with the lives of her characters here on Conversations. I've heard writers say that what they do is place characters, and you've said this to a certain extent, in a predicament, mm-hmm. and then see what those characters will do in a bar or in a war or in a family or whatever. In reading In the Land of Men, my sense of your writing is that it is as much of interior landscapes as of anything that happens in the external world. Mm-hmm. I mean, TV's had an external trauma, but clearly what's going on with him is pretty internal. Mm-hmm. Do you take your characters and place them in an internal landscape and see what they will do, or is it a different act?
I think that the two, the internal and the external, have to play off each other. I'm frequently telling students to make use of what I call acts of God in order to establish who their characters are. I think it's hard to come up with somebody who hasn't got anything to react against.
None of us.
Well, for example, what if you have a character driving along? Well, I can use an example from the first book. What if you have three characters in a car driving along who witness children mistreating each other on the side of the road? What kind of people drive right by that spectacle? Well, that's where a story started. Mm-hmm. Who are those people? And so I had to back up, since that's the last scene in a story. I had to back up and think, what kind of people simply drive by instead of stopping? What's compelling to me about people who would not stop? And they are people so messed up in their own friendships, particularly in the moment at which they're passing, what's happening on the side of the road. And what's happening on the side of the road in some way reflects the relationship in the car. Two men and a woman in the car, two boys and a little girl on the side of the road. I think characters are created really in a lot of instances by how they react to an event. The novella that I've just finished working on begins with a family that's gone through a tornado. And the youngest child in the family was in the womb during the tornado. I mean, fully formed, but still inside, and has always felt somehow away from the central drama of the family, somehow not a part of it, on the periphery. And symbolically, it's just... It begins with that notion of there being this storm and her being protected and not present and not fully formed, and her sense of being just in the shadow of the family's life. it prevails still. She has that sense. She's formed by that. Mm-hmm. And when I say acts of God, it's not always, you know, storms and traumas and, you know, floods and famine. It's frequently things, illness. I think all of us are formed by what happens to us as much as by what we do to exert ourselves in the world, maybe more so. And I think a lot of times when you're writing, you think you have to keep coming up with outward directed action from the inside out rather than having the character react to the external world.
Mm-hmm. I keep thinking about you as a writer as I'm listening to you describe your craft. Was writing an inevitability for you, given the questions that kind of hum in your mind?
Well, I really like to read, and I always have. And I was raised by English professors. But there are five kids in my family, and I'm the only one who pursued literature as a, you know, who pursued writing. So I don't think that makes it inevitable. I think probably the fact that I was my mother's first child, and I think that they lavished a great deal of attention on me. And I remember reading flashcards when I was 3 or 4, and you know, there was a lot of getting me to read and getting me to write early, and I took to it, and I was always rewarded for it. I think it was just a combination of things. I did not expect to be a writer. I think I thought of writers as being a fairly distant group of beings, not
distant
movie star, you know, out there, some other.
Not the guys that you pass in the grocery store.
Right.
I see.
Writers were celebrities to me, in a way, unreachable, you know, a dream occupation. My daughter says she wants to be a fairy when she grows up. A fairy princess.
A good
fairy?
I
think
fairy?
That's,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well.
I think that's how I must have thought of writers. So, I mean, I guess you have to take it that seriously, too, in order to dedicate your life to it. It has to mean something pretty large to you.
What do you think your culture thinks of writers? Do you think this culture places writers in the celebrity category now that you are one?
Some of them it certainly does. And some people certainly, you know, really respect writers. I don't think that as a country we treat writers as well as some other countries, but there's a lot to be said for getting to write what you want to write and not feeling restricted by that. I feel lucky in having an audience and in having success so far in getting my work published. I think I would feel differently. I think I would be giving you a completely different answer if my work was not being treated seriously, if I had gotten nothing but rejection notices from publishers. But that hasn't been my situation, so mm-hmm. I'm relatively happy. I think that a lot of people don't read literary work because they don't have exposure to it, or it isn't in front of them often enough. A lot of people think of reading as not unlike watching television or a certain kind of movie, where you go in order to escape your life, you go in order to be entertained, you pick up a book in order to fantasize about some other life. I have heard people say, I don't like to read your kind of writing because it's just like life, and you know, I have to live my life, and I don't like to get to a book and actually read about somebody else's miserable life. I'd rather go traveling into a fantasy land. And I'm sympathetic to that. It isn't why I read. I mean, I read in order to see things more complexly, to be more engaged, and ideally that's how people, and why people would be reading my work. But I think when people come to literary work after they've been reading a lot of genre work, they can frequently be pleasantly surprised by by the way their pain or their feelings about the world are validated and made real to them because mm-hmm. someone else has characters living those same lives. I think that can be, it can be a good thing.
Once again, this is Antonia Nelson on Conversations. Among Tony's awards and fellowships, she is, as I said, the winner of the Flannery O'Connor Award for Short Fiction. That was for The Expendables, her first collection of short stories. The O. Henry Award, the Nelson Algren Award, a Penn Syndicated Fiction Award, Mademoiselle Short Fiction Prize. You'll find her work in such anthologies as Prize Stories, the O. Henry Awards for 1993, Doubleday. That's forthcoming, right?
Mm-hmm.
At this interview time, it is forthcoming. Also forthcoming, Where Past Meets Present, modern-day Colorado short stories published by University Press of Colorado. And there are six other short stories of Toni Nelson's anthologized, including the O. Henry Award anthology and the Flannery O'Connor Award anthologies for 1992. I'm Susan McGinnis, and this is Conversations. This is a question about the politics of the artist, or the artist in the culture. Do you believe, as an artist, that you have any obligation to the society in which you live?
I think my obligation, well, there are several ways I guess it manifests itself. I feel like I have to, when I'm teaching, present students with the world of literature and to say to them, these stories are significant in what they tell us about the past and what they tell us about the present. And in the best situations, those stories present a world, trying to withhold judgment from that world and allowing the reader then to pass judgment and to decide how to continue to pass judgment on a world and on events in a world to become, you know, well-rounded. And their sense of the world. There's nothing like reading something by James Baldwin and suddenly understanding a sympathetic heroin addict. I mean, mm-hmm. that can be a very liberating and exciting process for, you know, Anglo students of the 1990s to be thinking about a black in Harlem in 1950. And I think that that sympathy can begin to generate sympathy for present-day people they may feel absolutely no kinship with. And I guess I would feel funny in trying to make an argument for my own work. I don't think it is as far-reaching as something like Sonny's Blues by Baldwin, but I do think that I'm trying to tell the truth. You know, I'm trying to get at what is honestly happening to real people. And these are people in general without a lot of money, and frequently people who are suicidal or depressed or trying to make sense of bad things in a family or in the world. I think one of my great subjects is self-hatred, great only in the sense of its being predominant.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, I think you could read work where there's a self-hating character, and if you had that inclination yourself, you might feel some comfort in not feeling alone and in maybe trying to take some steps. I guess I see that as a sort of service,
uh-huh.
As well as being something personally important for me to reckon with.
So I feel from you, I sense from what you're saying, obligations, if that's the right word, after mm-hmm. all, on a number of levels. And one is as a culture bearer for both students and for readers,
mm-hmm.
to bring the culture forward. But the other seems to be a mirror of some sort for, I don't know, for the individual or for the culture?
Mm-hmm.
Yes?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think a lot of what I'm doing is trying to figure myself out.
Mm.
And that makes it onto the page.
What does a writer have to be at this end of the 20th century? Well, she have to know?
I think she has to look at things with an open mind. I think you have to be able to recognize, in the way that you recognize a cliche, I think you have to be able, in the written text, I think you have to be able to recognize when you're looking at a situation what it is you're supposed to see symbolically and what is actually there. And I think those are frequently two different things. Then when you witness, you know, let's use an example from the book, three boys who abduct a rapist and tell their sister to make a decision. I mean, symbolically, I suppose they're doing the right thing. They're bringing this man to justice. But in reality, what I feel they're doing is putting the woman in yet another instance of victimization. They're making her a criminal in a way. Mm-hmm. And I think that what any writer has to be able to do is see through the symbols of a culture, to see through language that has become merely, full of cliches, and see what's actually being said and what that means.
Mm-hmm. Is that a process of rooting out for you as well? No clichéic thinking, that's a challenge. No clichéic writing,
another challenge. It is a way of just looking at the world. I find myself trying to step back and really assess what is happening in any given situation. The way you might have an argument with somebody and realize, no, we're not arguing about this, you know, spilled coffee or whatever. We are arguing about something much larger and much farther back in our history. You know, this is merely the catalytic event, mm-hmm. but there's something larger. There's a whole freight train going from each direction that bears with it all of, you know, our own baggage. And I think that's the kind of thing, you know, you have to be aware of larger implications as a writer. It makes the world more interesting. It makes you more sad, too, I think, in the world. I mean, I feel sad a lot of the time. You know, I can watch people having a conversation, watch kids interacting with parents and thinking, you know, I'll be thinking, at home they must, you know, I have this kind of large imagination for what must be behind things, and sometimes it's sad. Sometimes it isn't, but...
Will you read again for us?
Sure.
Actually, this is a story that made me very sad. The title of this one's Human Habits.
Yeah, this story is from the point of view of a man. I don't think he's very sympathetic either. Mm. Human Habits. Rory Elder was the kind of man who needed two homes, the one in which he lived and the one to which he escaped. He was just now in the latter, trying to discover why its thick walls seemed suddenly transparent, newly inadequate to the old task of protecting him. After all, he'd come here and been rescued before. The first time he returned to his bachelor house was after he and Marta had been married only 3 months. Marta's son, Beau, then 13 years old, had decided he wanted to live with his mother again. Beau was failing in New Jersey, where he lived with his father, stealing money and drinking beer. Marta bit her cuticles, looking anxiously at Rory as he decided, could her son come? Rory, though he'd never met the boy, felt a familiar kindred flame. In his chest, cocky pride blossomed. He would succeed where the first husband had not. Marta's face was fretful and vulnerable before him, inviting him to supply the compliments, strength, certainty. The boy, large and soft and pale-skinned, moved in. Rory could find nothing to inspire affection, the reality of Beau so much bleaker than the fantasy. It was clear he would not fit easily anywhere, his face locked into an outsider's sneer. He stood in the room Marta had cleaned for him and dwarfed the second-hand single bed, the boy's chest of drawers, the desk and chair. He would not study, Rory saw. He would not hang baseball posters or maps of the world. Rory resigned himself to a tougher job. He would approach Beau by circumnavigation, reach him when he least expected it. Marta worked hard those first weeks, trying much too blunt a method with the boy, laying options before him like a smorgasbord, and waiting hopefully for his decision. Beau was sullen with her and ignored Rory altogether, a condition for which Rory was often grateful. Beau went to the junior high down the street, a long brick building surrounded by an 8-foot chain-link fence, reassuringly prison-like. His disappearance each morning infused the house with air. Rory, who was between jobs, made appointments for the late afternoon so that he could take advantage of Beau's absence. He and Marta would return to bed in the morning, making love frequently, enjoying leisurely breakfasts afterward. With Beau safely gone, Rory believed he could master the difficult problems of marriage and stepfatherhood. Rory had stayed single well into his 30s, finally marrying a woman 3 years older than he. Marta had a kind of lively optimism Rory envied, his own vision having grown cynical. Most women would not tolerate it. On just their second date, Marta told him, "You lack innocence. I feel sorry for you." She'd held his hand maternally. She contained an enormous emotional repertoire that intrigued and baffled Rory, laughing out loud daily, able to weep in a heartbeat, completely alien. Rory envisioned their relationship as a symbiotic one in which he supplied the cloud and she the silver lining. He had known she would not stay single for long. There was no end to the men who wanted her, who confided in her, who were gratified in pleasing her. Yet she chose Rory. His friends, cynics like himself, came from everywhere for the wedding, convinced he would not go through with it. But here he was. Rory sometimes saw his wife as a whirling tornado, a gradually narrowing event that had left him, at last, with all other options and possibilities thrown from its central eye, the clear space where he now stood. All options, that is, except his small house.
Rory and human habits. It seemed remarkable to me as I read this story that Rory is our protagonist, our lead figure, and yet Rory mostly lets life whirl around him, and when he finds it uncomfortable, decides maybe he'll go out, go away from it, which makes Marta the story. And she sits, she doesn't sit, she's constantly moving, but she is almost always behind.
Mm-hmm.
Is that conscious, or did I just...
Well, I guess I'm interested in a man who keeps two homes. I uh-huh. had some interest in pursuing that. It's maybe interesting to me because I identify with him in some ways, that one wants to have the family and the happy life, and one wants to be an autonomous individual in a little house with all the freedoms in the world. And I don't think you can successfully negotiate both, and I think that's really the tension of the story, moving from one to the other and back and forth, and eventually he ends up in that little house but completely unhappy, and he's become entangled in the family.
Mm-hmm.
Not happily so.
And the garden is unkempt. I mean, neither mm-hmm. place is he
right.
Is he laboring in his own field.
Right. Hey, I think he begins identifying with a teenage boy, who creates a crib full of garbage mm-hmm. in reaction to the new baby in the house, and he's in a similar situation. I see it as a situation many men are in.
How about writers with a husband and two children and a teaching load? I mean, is that real for you too?
We've worked things out pretty well. I think the most important thing we did was hire a housekeeper so that the house can be as clean as I require it, and Robert doesn't have to worry about my being angry. we never argue about anything really except housekeeping, and so
sucks.
Once you identify that as a problem and you can manage to get away from it, why not?
Uh-huh. Do you find time enough to write and teach and nurture a household and be nurtured by a household? That's a lot of things in the air.
It works out, as long as I have a good idea for a story, everything is fine, because I can make time to write. If I'm not inspired to write something, or if I'm not in the middle of something, I think everybody's pretty unhappy. So it sort of means that I make myself be working, and I don't know, once you have a good idea, it's almost as if nothing else can get in the way of it, It really makes or breaks my mood.
Interesting. So the engine is well-oiled. when there's work.
Yeah.
When there's not, it all grinds for you.
Kinda. It makes me start assigning blame, you know. I can't come up with a good idea because I have too many papers to grade. It's not true. It's absolutely not true. It's uh-huh. merely a matter of having to be inspired. Traveling is very good for finding inspiration. I'm finding a lot of inspiration here in Alaska.
Good. Good. Now, I mentioned that you have a book of short stories forthcoming, just purchased, and also you mentioned a novella, and there is a novel mm-hmm. that is being worked on. Can you identify those three lives for us so that people can walk away with that information?
Well, the novella is a part of the short story collection. There are okay. seven stories in a novella, and that will be coming out sometime next year, March or April of 94. And that will be called Family Terrorists, I hope.
As long as Red Book doesn't get a hold of it.
Yes.
Right?
That's right. Family uh-huh. Trouble, they'll call it. The novel is as yet unwritten, and I've been working on the material of the novel for quite a long while and tried to make it into stories. I mean, that's really my inclination every time, to write a story, because one can work on them and be done with them, and they can either be praised or, you know, trashed, and one hasn't committed two or three years of one's life to something that will never see the light of day, which is the way it feels with a novel. I like, so far, I like the way the deal, the two-book deal, has made me feel about the novel, because it's given me both a comfort in that they want to see it, they want to publish it, and also some sort of pressure to get it done, and I kind of require pressure and security at the same time.
Best of both worlds.
Yeah. I'm, that's the way I'm seeing it today. Talk to me in a year.
We'll call you in 6 months and see how the pressure is doing. So look for Antonia Nelson to change her form a bit in the next couple of years and go for that long stretch, the novel, and in the meantime, Family Terrorist will be on the bookshelves in March or April of 1994, and the others, as we have indicated. Toni Nelson, thanks very much for an interesting
thanks.
Hour. I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Conversations. I hope you will join me again next week.